Hello and welcome back to SIGGRAPH Spotlight. Today's episode, moderated by SIGGRAPH 2018 Virtual Augmented and Mixed Reality Chair Paul Jeremias Vila, features two engineering leaders from Niantic Inc. The group discussed Niantic's SIGGRAPH 2018 Immersive Pavilion project, as well as how their team continues to push the limits of augmented reality through projects like Pokemon Go, Ingress, and more. Enjoy the show.
Hello, thank you for tuning in, and thank you to today's guests for joining me. My name is Paul Jeremias, and I am the SIGGRAPH 2018 Virtual Augmented and Mixed Reality Chair. Today, we are here to chat with some incredibly intelligent and talented engineers from Niantic. Before we dive in, I would like for each of you to introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us what it's like to develop for one of the world's leading augmented reality companies.
Sure. Thanks for having us, Paul. So I'm Diana Hu. I lead all the efforts for the AR engineering team. And what we do is building the real world platform from Niantic, which was just announced actually a week and a half ago, roughly in a press event that we had. And there's a lot of excitement work that's happening. We joined Niantic beginning of this year, and we were a team that just got acquired. We were Azure Reality before Niantic. So you can see some of that lineage, and now the announcement is very exciting because it's the culmination of a lot of the work that we were doing as Azure and bringing it into Niantic.
That's awesome. What about you, Ninian?
Hi, I'm Ninian Wang. I am Senior Director of Engineering at Niantic, and I oversee the feature games, including the Harry Potter Wizards Unite, Ingress, which is shipping Ingress Prime this year. And I also oversee parts of our platform, including social, sponsorships, events, CRM, and analytics. And it's very exciting to be part of Niantic. I also was part of an acquisition last year. I had started a startup that got acquired to form the social layer for Niantic's platform. And it's exciting to see how much the company has grown. It's more than doubled in size since I've been here. People are very bought into the mission of using technology to get people outside and meeting face-to-face and exploring the real world. So it's exciting to see that mission come to life before our eyes.
Awesome. Let's start big. So since both of you have a long history in augmented reality, can you share a bit about how the technology has evolved and a little bit of what excites you about engineering for augmented reality?
Yeah, I think we've been probably doing AR, even without knowing it. I've probably been doing it my whole career without knowing it, in a sense, until I connected all the pieces together about probably 4 or 5 years ago. Augmented reality is a very interdisciplinary field because it's this whole concept of, in order to augment the world with digital features and objects that are never seen or something very fantastical that is only exists in your imagination, you have to, on one side, be able to understand it. So there's a lot of computer vision, machine learning, and a lot of the foundations in AI from the visual images. And the other side is the whole aspect of augmenting it, and that's a lot with graphics and taking some of those components even with that design. So wind back a little bit. So before Niantic, I was the CTO and co-founder for Azure Reality. And we had started this company with mobile AR before it was cool. That was back in the day when all the companies that were raising a lot of money were all these ginormous headset companies that were raising hundreds of millions of dollars. And we were really contrarian back in the day. And everyone was pushing us, why don't you guys do hardware? And the bet that we were doing is that I think for sure the software was going to be ready way before hardware, because there's a lot of limitations in terms of where the technology is. And just forward a bit back of the history of AR, so AR really got started even at the beginning of computing. The very first headset was already dreamed of, if you can't believe it, more than 50 years ago. That was in 1968. That was by a computer scientist called Ivan Sutherland, who created this contraption that looks really weird, that he called, very funny, this is a very weird name of the headset, the Sword of Damocles. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct, the Sword of Damocles. It has this kind of mythical, kind of hellish name, but it really looks really weird if you Google it. Anyway, so he started that because back in the day in the 60s, where people were experimenting a bunch of devices and computing, he thought about what if you strapped a computer to your head and you had glasses that could see through. But of course, back then, computers were not ready at all, so he couldn't achieve very interesting visualizations. So that just got left and became a possibility. Then in the 90s, this technology got developed further, so more for military users, for fighter jet pilots, where all the visual augmentation of all the signals were simulating through jet plans. And then the technology was still very expensive and unreachable to users. And then fast forward a bit more, people started developing more in the 2000s. And 2016 was a very, very interesting year for a couple of things. So we started the company for Azure around end of 2015, beginning of 2016. 2016 was a very interesting year because I was mentioning how everyone was saying a naysayer for the company we started is like, oh, you should work on hardware because this is where everyone is doing it. So maybe there's a good reason to not do it because everyone is doing it. And there might be a reason why it hasn't picked up yet. So 2016 was an interesting year, first because the first headset that was usable was released, and that was Microsoft HoloLens, which came out in March. And then the people didn't know what AR was yet. What really happened that year where AR put it in the map that even your grandma would know it or your grandfather was really in the summer when Pokemon Go came out. That was unintended. People were dreaming that AR might have been this big vision that fulfilled the sci-fi version of Rainbow's End from Bernard Vinge. But in reality, it was just seemingly an assuming game that this company called Niantic had created and just took over the world by storm. I mean, the numbers in there, unlike any game that has been released in history, has been breaking records. And that's what has put really AR in the map for everyone, that now everyone really understands, and that kicked off big evolution on it and a lot of excitement from everyone.
This is a great answer. I have multiple follow-ups. Thank you so much. First of all, when you mentioned even Sutherland, actually, I was gonna bring up that he will be this year at SIGGRAPH. There will be a panel. So it will be good to go there, check that out. And also mention as well, when you were talking about that moment where Niantic focused on the software and kind of the realization that society moves kind of with the small incremental steps. And so instead of getting this like device that we would walk around the streets and see the world mixed in with digital items, we just expanded the capabilities of the thing we already had and used that to see augmented reality. For a lot of people, that seemed like an overnight success of this company called Niantic, which is, as we all know, it's not necessarily true. And I also want to dig a little bit, if you can tell us a little bit the history of Niantic, and was it an overnight success?
If you look at the trajectory of John Hankey, Niantic CEO, he was head of Meridian 59, which was the first massively multiplayer online graphical game, the first MMO of its kind. That got bought by 3DO. He started a company, Keyhole, which was mapping the Earth, and that got acquired by Google in 2004 and became Google Earth. And then John Hankey supervised parts of Google's geo-related initiatives, and in the 2010s started to experiment with different ways to use Google's geo data. So he and his department created Fieldship, which is a mobile app that would help users understand the interesting cultural landmarks around them. So as you explore your own city and your community, you would learn more about its historical significance. This then led to the creation of the game Ingress. And even when Ingress was in beta, users just fell in love with it. There was a spark that from the beginning caught on, and people were tattooing their Ingress game logos onto their own bodies when it was still in beta. People became very devoted, would charter helicopters to fly to different locations in order to play this game that was based on the real world. So through years of seeing how people act in the real world, Niantic was able to harness this knowledge and then build it into Pokemon Go. There's many things, details about how you set up collaborative or competitive elements in the real world, how to create interesting landmarks so that people are visiting locations that are historically significant instead of a parking lot or a place in the middle of the road. So I think it's interesting when you look at how graphics research is brought into real world applications and the process that takes in order to take something that you might see at SIGGRAPH, but actually get billions of people using it.
Could you tell us a little bit how Pokemon Go has evolved since the launch and how your team continues to push the frontiers of real world social gaming?
One story that I think is really interesting about the creation of Pokemon Go was how the AR mode came about. So people at Niantic had different ideas, different ways to sample imagery and create that experience. And one person had this idea that you would overlay it on top of the camera mode of what the user is seeing. And people are fairly skeptical as to whether that would be a good experience. So after some amount of debate, instead of further debate, the engineers decided to just try it. So they tried the approach of using some third-party imagery that's geo-based, and they found that it was too blurry when it was used on that scale. And then they tried the approach of using camera mode, and right away, it was compelling. So it only took a few hours to make the demo that showed people within the company that this way would actually work. And people would walk around and play with the demo, and that is how that came about. That similar process is used frequently now. When we work on features across all of our games, we will build a prototype and then people will actually walk around, sometimes in groups, and try it out. And when you take it from the research or ideation phase and actually put it onto your phone, there's a lot that you learn. Sometimes when you do an experience, you discover that you're standing in one place for a long time as people walk around you, and it feels like you're blocking foot traffic. Sometimes you might try out a new feature and feel like you're walking too slowly. It's been 10 minutes and you've only walked halfway down the block as you're playing this game. Sometimes it may feel that it's too long in between different spontaneous experiences in the game. When there are many people playing at the same time, sometimes it feels like you need to wait for someone else, or it can feel like all of you are standing in one spot together and you want to move around more. So by actually quickly prototyping these features and then going outside and playing with each other, Niantic is able to make these features broadly appealing. We just recently launched a large social feature in Pokemon Go of letting users become friends with each other and do trading. There were a lot of considerations around how to make sure that this works well with existing features and the existing environment. So we came up with the initial ideas and then discussed them and prototyped and played them. And as you actually do that on a daily basis, form friends, and then see how it feels on a day-to-day basis, the features can evolve over time. We also look at how the features are being used. We look at how many friends people have on average and what the behavior is between people in remote locations. And from that, we're able to make tweaks and prioritize the future work based on real-world usage of these features. So it's important with all of these features and products to put in metrics and then use a combination of looking at metrics and hearing from our users.
I think one thing that people don't realize even about what even AR is, funny enough, as Ninian described with Ingress, people are going to physical locations and really do performing some actions based on the game, like in Ingress, that even someone charter a helicopter to go to this remote location to play the game and get some special strategy in there. That's, in a sense, itself is AR, not in the sense that we like to think of it more with some graphical augmentation, but really this concept of merging the physical with the digital, and the digital might be in a conceptual level. It doesn't have to be something visual or with some graphics. But what we think about is a location that means something in the game as opposed to what it means physically. What I see could be just, let's say, in the middle of nowhere, a forest. But in Ingress could be this amazing base and secret location for agents to go and play.
Yeah, this is very Very, very interesting. And when you were mentioning the kind of this separation between the, in my mind, I guess I'm just mapping it to the graphics side of AR and the more database, if we just go into like, you know, kind of like plain computer science concepts, and one providing the recognition of the space and one providing the scale. What do you think are the hardest problems that are yet to be solved in these two areas? And also feel free to correct me if I oversimplify it.
Yeah, I think the hardest problem, I guess I could break it down. I think it's more than just, those are the main two in a sense, the understanding the world in a sense, and then the augmenting with the graphics. So as I was mentioning earlier, funny enough, I think everyone probably, if you have worked in computer science, you probably have worked on pieces in AR because it's such a interdisciplinary field. So, I mean, first, as I was mentioning, you need to understand the world in order to augment it. And that's really the field of computer vision and probably also machine learning and statistical models or AI. And that's where there's many, many methods of solving it. So could be from the lowest level of computer vision, which has to do with understanding the geometry. And in that sense is when you are building a representation of the world and kind of just understanding the layout. And algorithms in this space are the ones that tell you that where you can build point clouds in a sense. So it's kind of getting the 3D-ness in a sense. Now, the other aspect also that comes in understanding of the world, which there's a lot of exciting advancement with deep learning, has to do with more the semantic understanding of the world, really semantic meaning the meaning. So the first, what I mentioned earlier, was sort of the low level of the 3D-ness, the geometry, and now semantics with knowing that, okay, this blob of points is really a chair versus is a TV or is a bookcase or it could be a tree. In a sense, they all could be just points in the first set of algorithms, but in the second one, it really tells you what it is. And you could do a lot more interesting things that we haven't seen a lot in AR yet, but interacting really with objects and this environment and space at that detail level, at the object level. That's kind of the other part of it.
I think that in addition to Dan's amazing answer, in artificial intelligence right now, there's a lot of talk of human in the loop, of that artificial intelligence can bring you so far, and then a human or a team of humans takes you the last stretch. And I think that in augmented reality, we have computer vision and machine learning and deep learning. So that can take us so far, but there's some amount of understanding the real world that we need humans to take us the last mile. So things like when you're mapping a game or product on the real world, which are the landmarks that people find significant in their local community? If you were to, for example, give someone directions, which are the local landmarks that they would be familiar with? What are the things that a expert who grew up in this area would understand about this neighborhood and would be able to tell a new person who's moving there? So for example, with Niantic Games, when we pick points of interest for people to play the game around, we like to pick areas that have local cultural significance. And you can only use AI so far to get that kind of information. You have to empower the user base to give you some of that information.
I remember last week I saw a video from Niantic of Pikachu running around, which was really, really impressive. And I was wondering if you guys can talk a little bit about that and about the problems. Why is that something impressive?
Yeah, so why that is impressive, that's basically, you're talking about occlusion. So that is basically taking this concept of understanding the world, taking a different, completely different approach, which is actually using deep neural nets to build a depth mask where from a single image, so these are regular phones, there's no stereo cameras or any, I don't know the details, it's from a monocular camera, single feed RGB, you build the depth mask. And that is a very hard problem to take a single image and get depth. And this work came out a lot about from another team that Niantic just recently acquired, which is this great team that spun off from University College London. And they've done some amazing work where they published actually in CDPR a couple of papers. So very, very exciting work. It's just taking a completely different approach on where traditional way of building depth, maybe from monoculars with different methods with a combination of SLAM and VINS, where you have a gyro oscillometer that's complicated algorithm. With here, just take a single image, and then the deep neural net does its magic, which is a bit of black magic, deep neural nets today. They tune it up and build the output to be a death mask. And why that is hard is because there's a lot of complexity in the world to really understand where even the distance of a particular pixel, where that is. Even traditional methods, let's say with some, even with a how you bet the most reliable way of building depth today is with things like LiDAR, where it's basically rays of light that get shooted in an array, and based on the time of flight, you calculate the depth when it refracts back. But of course, light has issues because it's known, this is a funny thing, I think it was known in certain models of a lot of LiDARs with black cars can't detect them because black objects absorb light. It has challenges. So with a camera approach, it can solve some of these issues. It will see the black car. So that's just one detail in self-driving cars. The other reason why this is hard, I mean, the funny thing about we computers right now is that we got to the point where a lot of the things that we as human used to think that were that are easy because they come natural to us, they're very, very hard for computers. So it's this whole thing about understanding objects, visual depth and semantics is really hard for computers, where logical things like solving chess or Go are things that are easier, quote unquote, for computers. So it's still really hard. And another data point why it's hard is that some of the technique that were highlighted in that video in Niantic for Hollywood professionals in the special effects world in Hollywood, they have this giant rigs of cameras and very, very careful timing in order to do things like what you saw in that video. And that video was a single cut without any special cameras or timing and hand tuning of any sort as a special visual effect. So it has an enormous potential.
Right. It was really, really impressive. I was also wondering, have you seen anything outside of the walls of Niantic that you think is impressive or that you think is interesting as well in the field of AR?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of exciting work in more in the research space that you don't, that is less known per se because you want to come back up, but you see a lot of the traces of it coming early on. And there was a lot of great work in CVPR, and some of them have to do with applying deep learning methods in sort of understanding geometry.
So applying deep learning to solve the recognition problem?
Yeah, the recognition problem in a different sense, not in the sense of as a labeling that this object is A or B, because that has been done a lot with challenges like ImageNet. But in a sense of rethinking how to do SLAM or 3D understanding with more adding some deep learning methods into it.
And when you were referring to CVPR, could you tell us a little bit for the audience that might not know?
Oh, yeah. What CVPR is, CVPR is one of the largest computer vision recognition conferences. So the way to think about it, I guess another thing is computer vision is sort of the inverse of graphics in a sense. Computer graphics and computer vision are very much kind of like twins of some sort. So computer vision takes the input, takes the real photons of the life and trying to understand that this is a chair, or this is how the environment is looked, or this is a forest or a sea. Whereas computer graphics is taking some programming instructions to then render out and push out photons to show us in a scene and render it. So kind of the output.
So I wanted to go a little bit into your backgrounds. And if you could tell us the story of your careers as engineers and what led each of you to augmented reality or just, you know, immersive technologies in general, and then ultimately how that led you to Niantic.
Well, I studied computer science at Caltech. I actually graduated when I was 18. Probably my favorite class there was the computer graphics course, where I spent an excessive amount of time making a ray tracer and doing other graphics projects. I went to Microsoft Games right out of school. It was a very good experience in learning about software engineering in the real world and shipping on time and performance. So I worked on Flight Simulator and I led a team that was doing weather effects. So rendering clouds, now when people say cloud rendering, they mean something different, but we were rendering three-dimensional weather and clouds, rain and snow. I actually presented at SIGGRAPH in 2003, the rendering of clouds, and then in 2004 of rain and snow. SIGGRAPH was an amazing experience for me 15 years ago because I had been immersed in this world of Microsoft and gaming, and at SIGGRAPH it opened my eyes to the enormous diversity of people of all over the world, different academics and research and the visual effects industry. There's just so many different ways to use graphics. It was a really exciting and eye-opening experience. So after 5 years at Microsoft, I went to Google in 2003. I co-founded Google Desktop Search, search files on your computer. And then when Gmail launched, I led the engineering for Gmail ads and revenue. And then I created a project called Google Lively, which was a early product to let people create avatars and have a 3D graphical representation of them and their environment within the browser. It was a short-lived project, but we learned so much about how early on people wanted to self-express, create an avatar, and how they chat and create virtual rooms with each other. After 5 years at Google, I went into the startup world and I was CTO of Minted, which is a crowdsourced community of people to create graphic design, so 2D design. But I learned a lot about what people consider art and how you can crowdsource the leading trends in design. And then I started my company Evertune, which let people make 3D animated content and share it. There was a social network where people could friend each other and send messages. And then we were acquired by Niantic. So it's been a really interesting experience over the years of seeing how graphics has evolved. And back from when I was at Microsoft, we had to enable software rendering. So we were rendering overcast skies, but sometimes all in software on devices. We had to work even if there was no separate graphics video card. And funny enough, now I feel like it's come back to that, because on phones, we have similar computing power to what we used to have on PCs. So we still have similar restrictions with memory and with fill rate and so forth. So I think it's also interesting to see what we've learned with how people represent themselves with avatars. Before, I had learned at Google, I had learned that a smaller percentage of people want to try these really out there representations, like a huge mushroom or a robot or a small animal. And then the majority of people wanted to be a taller, slightly skinnier version of themselves with their hair color, their hairstyle, their eye color, everything like themselves, but a little bit stretched taller. So for those people, it's really important to have their hairstyle. So sometimes you need hundreds of hairstyles so they can feel it represents them. And it's interesting to see how we've learned. And so as we approach augmented reality, it's also, and people need to self-express, I think some of those same learnings come into play of, you have the trendsetters who are always trying something new. And they also, you can tell when they choose clothing. So when you do user studies, there'll be people who come dressed in all sorts of interesting outfits and shoes, and like the way they do their hair is very innovative. And those are the people that want their avatar to be some character with wings, like that's, you know, three stories tall, or some really tiny robot. And then you have the people who are more mainstream, who will not be quite as early adopters, and they want an avatar that really looks like them. But they want it to be cartoony enough. So you have to, you know, avoid the uncanny valley with their avatar. It's been interesting to see how, you know, we started back on PCs, then mobile, and now with augmented reality, you have the same challenges of self-expression and of using technology to enable people to communicate and express themselves.
That was a great, great answer.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. What about you, Diane?
Yeah, Minion did very well. I'm just trying to
think. I really, really enjoyed SIGGRAPH. I want to say that, you know, going to SIGGRAPH was great. There were so many different grad students and research teams, and it was really eye-opening for me, and to see graphics being used in all these different industries and areas. Okay, Diana, I was just buying you time to think some more.
I was listening. Let's see. So a bit of background for me. I grew up in a very unlikely place. I grew up in a remote place in Chile that you probably don't even know the city. So that's in Latin America, in the tip of it and near the desert. And as when I was younger, I used to read a lot. And one of my favorite books when I was young was one on from Jules Verne's The Journey to the Center of the Earth, and a lot of other sci-fi books. And the fun thing about that book was just very fantastical kind of depiction of what the center of the earth might be. I thought about how you could build something to experience like that. And I was always curious of building things when I was younger. And at some point, a series of events happened and I ended up studying in the US. I went to Carnegie Mellon and I started in different majors, but ended up doing electrical computer engineering because I was really into building more like hardware, but then ended up doing software. And really, at that point, I really kind of came to really, really obsess and really like the field of machine learning, actually. So I liked, in some sense, the elegance of math representing the messiness of the world with data. And with that, I also got a focus in computer vision. So I did not only my bachelor's, but also my master's at CMU. And then I was actually had applied and had offers to go to a couple PhD programs to focus more and do more machine learning. I decided not to do that. And when that ended up going to industry for various reasons, mostly financial. And then I ended up going to work at Intel in this program that was a rotation program. It was supposed to be a leadership training program for tech leaders in the future. So my I worked in many, many business units with right alongside of all the different leaders at Intel. And that was a very, very good experience. I worked from back in the day, the Intel Atom business unit, which was the one taking charge of bringing processors into small devices. And one of the fields I was focusing was how to use Intel Atom processors for computer vision in embedded devices. So that was in many, many different areas, from industrial machine vision to other devices that are yet to be released, or this, I think they released some of them actually. So they released. The other was I ended up working in the Intel labs and working in large scale machine learning. And then after that, I ended up working in the office for the chief of product. And that was very good experience, bringing more the strategy and the vision of a company at Intel size, which is close to about 100,000 employees, and understanding how a company like that thinks about technology. And it's funny to see that I was there about six years ago. And it's funny to see that the strategy that was getting discussed with the chief of product back then is only coming to fruition in last year, in the last couple of years. So it takes that long to bring that kind of vision, that size of company, into actual products for people. Now, fast forward that, I ended up going to in a spin-off to build up a compute and a television product. And in that team, I built up the data science team and led that team to build recommender systems for television, and also built up this interesting project, which had to do with automatically detecting where commercial breaks are in the live feed of television. So I was sort of bringing computer vision products. So that whole experience of doing that. And then that division, I mean, that startup kind of got acquired by Verizon. And then after that, I left and started my own company, which was, I think I mentioned earlier, Esher Reality as a CTO. And then after that, got acquired and joined Niantic.
This is great. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, the summary started from many different fields and ended up doing sort of machine learning, data science, computer vision production, dabble in hardware, and now in Niantic.
So despite working in the same field, you both have a unique relationship with SIGGRAPH and the augmented reality community. What does it mean to be part of this community and also contribute to the conference program? And also, if you could offer a preview for the listeners of the project that you will be showcasing in Vancouver this summer as part of the Immersive Pavilion, that would be great.
I think SIGGRAPH is unique in that it brings together people from so many industries, and it has this idealistic core of wanting to use graphics to make different industries better. So you have people from the film industry who share secrets of how they made the latest visual effects. You have grad students and professors from universities all around the world, and you have different companies that come and talk about their technologies. So it's such a great way to see a broad cross-section of all of these different arenas. And when I presented before, people were told not to make it too commercial. It should be really focused on the technology and on the research or the graphics. So I think those make it a really interesting combination of people from different countries and industries.
I guess now what Niantic is bringing to SIGGRAPH this year is this multiplayer AR demo called Neon, which you can actually see a teaser video of it from our press announcement. One of them is a fast player versus player kind of combat game where people are kind of shooting this magical bullet in and it tracks people. It has this really cool name tag that really tracks the location of the phone. And one of the technology pieces that we built is this custom fast networking piece that has very, very low latency so that it really looks amazing how it tracks where everyone is and all the effects. And it can have even up to more than 6 people playing for sure. And it's a combination of cross-platform for iOS and Android.
I can't wait. Actually, I'm really excited to try myself. And for our listeners who will be joining us at the conference, be sure to check out Diane and Inyan and the rest of the Niantic team's project called Multiplayer Augmented Reality, The Future is Social, as part of the Immersive Pavilion. Thank you for tuning in today. And thank you to Diana and Inyan for joining us on the podcast.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
If you're still listening, thanks for tuning in to this installment of SIGGRAPH Spotlight. If you like the show, please subscribe or leave us a review on iTunes. To learn more about today's guests and SIGGRAPH 2018, check out the links in our show notes. We hope to see you August 12th through 16th in Vancouver.